Okay, so we're going to get started here now. This is the first floriculture session. We've got four speakers. I am your first speaker of the day. My name is Jim Faust. I'm at Clemson University, and I'm going to be talking on the domestication of the poinsettia over the past half century. Fortunately, the Pawlecki Ranch, which is well known for their association with poinsettias, has saved every poinsettia that's ever been grown, it seems like. And so they have a collection of a lot of old varieties, and they've been kind enough to share them with me. And so the last couple years, we've been growing these varieties and doing some flowering comparisons. This may be a little bit unusual presentation in that I'm not going to give you any data. I'm just going to show you some pretty pictures and take you a little bit of a travel log through the last century or so of poinsettia domestication. So this is just a list of the varieties. We have varieties representing each decade from the 1910s onward, which is kind of exciting to see them flower for the first time. And then we have a wild one that I collected in Mexico to compare to. As you probably know, Euphorbia pulcherrima is native to the west coast of Mexico and down into Guatemala. And there's a tremendous amount of variation in the wild varieties. Last couple years, I've made trips around at the end of the year to explore some deep canyons looking for wild poinsettias. And one of the more exciting things I've ever done in my career to get to go see some wild poinsettias. They tend to be gangly shrubs, grow about 15 feet tall, not well branched, fairly narrow bracts. There are Mexican breeders today that are actually going out and collecting a lot of wild poinsettias and introducing them into their breeding programs. And so this is a slide that they shared with me, showing you the diversity in inflorescence appearance of poinsettias across the countryside. The first European artwork depicting poinsettias came out and was made in 1788 as part of the Cesce Massino expedition in Mexico and up the west coast of the United States. And so this is the first drawing we have of poinsettia in the wild. And you can see big open centers, a lot of cyathia spread out, very narrow bracts, and on very tall plants. And then 40 years later, of course, there have been herbarium specimens collected for several decades in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But Joel Poinsett, his name being attached to the plant since, he actually sent the first live plants from Mexico to the United States. He was an ambassador to Mexico, a native South Carolinian, and he was an avid horticulturist that really believed in the exchange of plant material around the world to see what might become economically successful and useful plant material. So he was involved in a lot of plant exchange. Just 8 years after Poinsett sent plants to the U.S., and then they made their way to Europe, there was the first botanical drawing of those plants was made in the Curtis Botanical Magazine, 1836. And what's really interesting about this is how beautiful that poinsettia is, or how modern it looks. It doesn't look at all like that wild one that I just showed you, which either the artist had a great imagination, or what probably is more likely the case is that Poinsett was not a botanist that traveled out into the woods looking for wild poinsettias. He was interested in plants that had economic value, and so it's likely that he collected plants from the marketplace, plants that had already been domesticated by the Aztecs, because the Aztecs were known to have a botanical garden before the Europeans arrived, and then you start to see European botanical gardens popping up in the 1500s after they had seen Montezuma's gardens in Mexico. So the Aztecs probably really deserve credit for the initial domestication of the product, of the plant. And then a couple years later, the first white poinsettia is depicted in this artwork. Looks a little bit more like the wild ones, a little ganglier. And then 1873, the first double poinsettia was discovered by a Czech botanist who was actually a orchid hunter. And he found this double poinsettia in Mexico and sold it to a New York florist for $1,000 for one cutting, which was a lot of money in that day. And that double poinsettia actually became the first poinsettia ever patented. Excuse me. The patent system in the U.S. started in the early 1830s. By 1836, the first poinsettia was patented, and it was a double. It was patented by a guy from Port Arthur, Texas. And then the Ecke Ranch acquired it and later named it Henrietta Ecke after Paul Ecke Sr.'s mother. And then they added Supreme on an improved version of that in the 50s. Excuse me. One of the earlier varieties of sport that was found in the 1910s in Missouri called St. Louis, as you can see, has very narrow bracts, large, wide saeti in the center, was popular, very tall. Even today, it's the most aggressive growing plant that we have in our collection of plants that we grow. Oak leaf was discovered in the 20s in New Jersey, and it's the plant that Paul Weckey Sr. Chose a lot of sports from over the next several decades. So a lot of the varieties from the 20s, 30s, 40s were sports of oak leaf. Indianapolis is actually an impressive plant with a lot of modern characteristics, found in Indiana in the 30s. Again, fairly tight centers, not big open centers, and actually has a fairly flat appearance of the bracts. I'll show you a picture of that later. And it was a fairly compact plant, so it actually had some good modern characteristics. Paul Weckey Sr., as I mentioned, is kind of thought of as the person that really commercialized poinsettia. And of course, there's a lot of people involved in that, but he gets a lot of the credit for it. He grew poinsettias as a cut flower in Hollywood, California, starting in the 1910s through the 20s and through the 50s. He found sports in his field, would name them after family members. Ruth Weckey is one of his daughters. And you can see these are cut flower varieties, very tall and very droopy bracted plants. You know, really not that showy in some regards, but they were popular and kind of spurred the initial development of the plant commercially. Barbara Ecky Supreme, another daughter of Paul Sr., introduced in the 50s, was the dominant variety throughout the 1950s. It is a tetraploid with very large bracts. The bracts can be 12, 14 inches long, somewhat curled. They don't lie flat. And then the saeti are as big as the tip of your finger. They're huge saeti. And the honeydew, the nectary gland, has a big drop of honey on it that's really sweet. So you can just kind of, you can lick them and they taste quite good. Then, really, the problem with poinsettia to really make a commercial product at that point was it dropped its leaves in the retail environment. So you'd grow a plant in the greenhouse and immediately you put it into a darker environment and all the leaves fall off. So what growers, this is a picture from the 1910s, what growers would do was actually would plant a fern in the middle of the pot so that when all the poinsettia leaves fell off, you still had some green foliage to make the plant look nice. The other problem with them was these were all tall cut flower varieties and they didn't do that well in containers. So what you would do is bend the stems. You'd take to make them shorter, you would macerate the stem with your fingers and it would bend over, and then you macerate the stem again and bend it back up, and you would take a plant that's tall and make it short very quickly. Although it's a fairly laborious process, but that is what was done to make them short. And then we had a breeder with USDA, Dr. Bob Stewart. He really made the great leaps in breeding in the 50s, and in the 60s introduced the first several cultivars that the USDA just handed over to the industry. They don't do that anymore, but this basically did initially a lot of breeding and then just handed to the industry, here's some plants that now you guys can commercialize them. So Stoplight was one of his varieties, and you can see it. He was selecting for, again, tight saeti, wider bracts, a nice flat appearance so they weren't droopy, and then the main characteristic that he was looking for was leaf retention. And also, he introduced the first genetic pink. We had pinks at this time, but they were chimeral pinks. They were not genetic. And so he had USDA at that time would travel the world collecting plants and sending them back, trying to find new and different things. And this was a plant that was shipped out of Mexico in the 50s. Then Jim Mickelson, an Ohio grower, did some breeding, and he introduced a plant that he named after his father, Paul Mickelson, in 1963, and this plant became the dominant variety in the 1960s, and it isn't that impressive of a plant in terms of its flower, but the leaf retention was so good that it pretty much displaced all of the Ecky varieties at that time, and so Mickelson really became the dominant poinsettia company in the 60s. But then the Eckys kind of came back with success. They went out and took, they had a gardener who on staff that was quite bright, and they said, well, you're our new breeder. We've never bred poinsettias before, but here's how you dust pollen. And Franz Frühwirth ended up becoming the major poinsettia breeder. To this day, he's the most renowned poinsettia breeder. More varieties he has introduced and more innovations he has introduced than anybody else. This was his third year of breeding, and he introduced C1, and you can see that thing looks like a modern commercial variety. It is very impressive. You could sell it today, other than it has fairly light green leaves and kind of more of a scarlet colored bract, which is not really the trend right now. Then later in the 60s and into the 70s, the dominant varieties were the Annette Hegg series, and this was when a Norwegian grower found a plant in their greenhouse that was branching freely, and poinsettias didn't branch very well, so you'd have to put multiple plants in a pot, and so now you could just put one plant in a pot and it would branch well. So the way he didn't know how he got free branching to his plants, and nobody else did until Gregor Gutbier, a German breeder, this little backyard hobbyist breeder, really, he discovered that you could take this breeding branching factor and transmit it to any new genetics or other shoot plants by grafting. And so this branching factor was graft transmissible, and it was later by John Doe, our ASHS president, and later USDA scientists identified that it was actually a phytoplasma's a bacterium that infected the plants that caused the free branching. And Gutbier introduced several interesting varieties that were showy, but basically they were old varieties that were just grafted. So V14 Glory was simply C1 grafted onto free branching rootstock. And just to give you some idea, this is V17 Angelica, popular variety in the 80s. That's the bract, and this is a wild type bract, to see the enormous change in bract size. Late 80s, we started having dark green leaves, which displaced all the medium, lighter green leaf varieties, and so now the industry demands this dark, almost blackish green color in the leaves. Freedom became very popular in the 90s, and still we have growers grow Freedom today, which is like 30 years later, because it's the most heat-tolerant variety. It has very large bracts, and as you get these very large bracts, you end up with cyathia that are smaller and smaller and fewer. If you actually remove the bracts, the cyathia develop well, but when the bracts are so big, most of the energy of the plant is partitioned into the bract, not the cyathia. And the curly leaf bracts from Franz Frewerth. Prestige Red is still the dominant variety in the U.S. today. Again, huge bracts, very small cyathia. One of our, I think, more interesting observations in growing these things side by side is to note, when you look at the morphology of the plant, these are the cyathia in the center, and then with the wild type, you get a couple red bracts, and then this one's kind of reddish green, these are reddish green, and you have a bunch of green leaves on the stem. And Barbrecki Supreme in the 50s, a little bit more red going down the stem. But if you look at Prestige today, what you see is that the bracts down the stem, the leaves turn red. And so what we've inadvertently selected for is earlier bract development and the time of flowering. Cyathia development is similar on all of these, but the modern varieties have much earlier bract development. And so they're marketable earlier. So that's 100 years of domestication, from the gangly wild Mexican shrub to I don't know what you really think of this. It is beautiful, but it's a little different. It's a modern version of beauty, I suppose. That's Prestige Red on the right. So the improvements, as I've gone through, the leaf retention was critical. Shorter pedicels, shorter internodes, flat, horizontal, large bracts, dark green leaves. Which the beauty of the dark green leaves is that you have a reduced nutritional requirement. We tend to fertilize plants, poinsettias now, with about half the nitrogen as we did even 10, 20 years ago. And that's mostly because of the breeding. Deeper red bracts, free branching, stem strength of Prestige really has changed the marketplace also, where the stems don't break off very easily during shipping, and then earlier bract development. I haven't shown you all the responses to that have been physiological improvements, but poinsettias have been very ethylene susceptible, and we call the ethylene response epinasty. There are some things like rabbit tracks, latex eruption, bract abrasion, cyathia abscission. All these things were significant problems that have been bred out of the plant that makes a much, much easier plant to grow today than it was 30 years ago. So where do we go from here? Production traits, you can't get much more showy than we have, and so the production traits tend to be where breeders are heading. If we could get whitefly resistance, would be fabulous, Pythium resistance, self-branching without phytoplasma, because breeding seedlings and then having to graft them all to get the new variety is cumbersome. Heat tolerance is still a challenge for us. And then novelty bright colors and patterns are certainly a lot of neat things come up. But people at the end of the day still buy red ones. So there's only so much you can do with novelty colors and bracts. So I have time for one question maybe. Yeah, the interspecific hybrids are a cross between Euphorbia pulcherrima and Euphorbia cornastra. Cornastra has a much smaller geographical distribution. There's only two places in Mexico where it's known to grow. Cornastra was removed from Mexico in the 90s and hybridized embryo rescue in order to get viable material from the cross. So. A lot of interest in hybrid euphorbias, but still not real common in the marketplace. All right. Thank you very much for your time.